Mitzvah Shin Sadi Test 399. Mitzvahs Mei Nida, the waters of sprinkling. Shemetamin Adam Tahor Umetaharin Adam Tamei. So they impurify a pure person and they purify an impure person. Mitumas Mei Spilvad. The waters of the Parah Aduma, the waters of sprinkling, are totally ineffective for any other type of tumah. For every other type of tumah in the world, all that is required to purify oneself is an immersion. Immersion usually takes place in a mikveh, although there is a higher level of mikveh, a super duper mikveh, which is called a mayan. And a mayan is a actual live flowing spring. And that is the only thing that is effective for the purification of a zav, a male who is suffering from an unusual discharge. The Tosefta states that a zava, a female who's suffering from an unusual discharge, does not require purification in a mayon. But there is a minority opinion, interestingly enough, in the Rishonim that holds that even a zava requires purification in a mayon. So, which leads to a big chumra nowadays, because the reason that all women nowadays, when they become nida, they have to count shiva nikiyam, 7 clean days, is because of a concern that maybe they're not really nidos, maybe they're really zavos. So according to some geonim, Rav Nachman Agon writes in a tshuva that nowadays all women require immersion in a spring when they wish to conclude their nida status. So that's obviously not such an easy proposition.
In Brooklyn, in Washington.
So in Brooklyn, it might not be so hard, actually. There's apparently a lot of spring water. If you dig down far enough, maybe even in Manhattan also, there's spring water if you dig down far enough. But the problem is that when you dig down and you fill the mikveh in a building with a spring water, it's not so clear under what circumstances the actual, the building, the pool in the building, even if it's filled with spring water, would actually have the status of a spring when it's disconnected from the source of a spring. So you might solve other problems with mikvos if you fill it from spring water instead of from rainwater, but this chumra you don't necessarily get. There are some chassidish groups, I think, that are makbid on this, and they try to have their mikvos for women be at least as close as possible to a spring, but of course, this is not the normal practice, and we assume that a zava does not require a mayim chayim, but requires a mikvah only. Okay.
Does the ocean or a river qualify?
As a mikvah, so the ocean for sure qualifies, but not for a zav.
Not
a zava, no. And if you hold this chumra for a zava, so the ocean wouldn't be good enough. It would have to be a spring of fresh water that flows forth from the ground, yeah.
So, source of a river, for example.
Source of a river would be good, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The actual source of the river would be good.
Mm-hmm.
And
the river itself would not be.
Yeah, there is an issue about rivers in general. So the issue with rivers in general is we know that if you have a mayon or a source of actual... So for this purpose, the ocean is considered like a mayon, not for a zav. But for the ocean, it's considered like a mayan to the extent that you don't need the water to stand still in order to be a kosher mikvah. So in other words, if you fill up a pool with rainwater and the rainwater is constantly flowing out of the mikvah and you're replenishing it with rainwater somehow, that's puzzle. That's not a kosher mikvah at all. But the water has to be standing still. So a ocean does not have to be standing still. The ocean works as a mikvah, even though the ocean is obviously not standing still. It's a whole lumdus exactly what the definitions of these things are. Okay, so that's the ocean for sure is good. But the river, you might have a problem because a river is flowing, so it depends. If the river mostly is constituted of water that flows from the source of the river, so then it is good, even if it's flowing. But if you have a river, say, which is just very tiny during most of the year, and then during the rainy season, it gets completely swelled with rainwater, so then you have a problem. Then the river might not be good if it's flowing. So then, but most rivers, which stay basically the same all year round, should be good. But there was this problem in Europe that they had a lot of rivers that used to swell a lot during the rainy season. So there was a whole disagreement about whether that was kosher as a mikvah or not. So I think there was this issue that, but that's the, but a river is, in general, a river is good, but unless you're using a, wish to use to immerse in a mikvah that's under proper rabbinical supervision or an actual ocean, then it's best to check out with an appropriate authority whether this body of water is kosher as a mikvah or not. Yeah.
An artificial well that's dug by humans, because that's perfectly fine, right?
Not because that comes from rain. That's just that's just spring water.
A Mayan, you know. That's a Mayan. It doesn't have to be a natural Mayan, you know.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't have to be a Mayan. Yeah. It doesn't have to be a natural Mayan. That's why then some mikvahs. So I remember hearing a story about the Passaic mikvah that they wanted to do it. And it solves a lot of halachic problems, because there is an opinion that you always need 40 se'ah, which is the minimum shear of a mikvah. You need 40 se'ah of rainwater in the mikvah. So the normative psak is that once you have a 40 se'ah of kosher water, in other words, collected rainwater, not drawn water, collected rainwater, or rainwater from another natural source that has not been drawn, has never been in a bucket or a vessel or that kind. So you can add as much water as you want, and it can never become pusle. So even if, for example, you have a you have your original mikveh with the 40 se'ah of rainwater, if you have your 40 se'ah of kosher water, and then let's say you have that in a pool over here. This is our pool of 40 se'ah of rainwater. And now we're building another pool down here that's empty. We have in that pool down here that's empty. So you could take jugs of water, buckets of water, and pour them into this and have it overflow and go into this. And this will be, they'll both remain a kosher mikvah, even though obviously in this one, there'll be less than 40 se'ah of molecules of actual original kosher water. So according to the normal shita, there's no limit on that. Then this mikvah becomes empty somehow. This mikvah gets drained out. You can do it again. You can pour, even though nothing remains of the, almost nothing, just a few molecules of the original water remains in here. So that's good. So, but the Rambam and the Ravid seem to hold, maybe. I mean, they seem to hold this, but the question whether it would apply even in the situation I just told you about, that you always need to have the 21 sa'ah, so more than half of the original 40 sa'ah, you need to always have that in the remaining in the mikvah.
How could you possibly tell? I mean, water evaporates, you know.
Water evaporates?
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Not if it's indoors.
Well,
yes, it does. Of course
it does. I mean, evaporates a little bit.
They're watering my plants.
So that's one problem. How can you tell? Okay, but to the... I mean, if you have it in an enclosed area as opposed to an open pool, so then it doesn't evaporate that much. And if you don't add water to the, I mean, I don't want to go into now the building of mikvahs, but if it's an enclosed container, that's not going to evaporate much. And if you don't add water to that container, then you know how much water is still remaining in that thing. Yeah.
Is it possible to use snow?
Yeah. So snow is kosher. It's only water that becomes disqualified when it's in a vessel. So in theory, you could have a empty pool, and then you could bring snow in buckets, and then pour it into the mikvah and let it defrost, and then that would be a kosher mikvah. Yeah. So that's why. It's a little bit difficult to control. So they try their best when you have a regular rainwater mikvah that there should at least be 21 sa'ah of original rainwater molecules at all times. There are various methods and devices that they have to try to control this, but it's an imperfect science. So therefore, that's why, ideally, if possible, so a better way to build the mikvah is to dig, and have all the water in the mikvah supplied by a natural spring. So that way you never have to add, in other words, if you're collecting, like in the Washington Heights mikvah, so they collect rainwater. They collect rainwater, and then that's not enough to last. If you want to clean the mikvah with regularity, you can't use only rainwater, so they have to add tap water to the kosher mikvah water. So you run the risk. Again, they try the best they can, but you run the risk. Again, according to the normative psak, it's not a problem anyway, but everybody tries to be choshish for this. But and you run the risk of getting down to less than 21 se'ah of original rainwater molecules. So that's why if the whole thing is if you have the mikvah connected down deep to a natural spring and all the water in the mikvah supplied by that, then you never run into this problem. You don't use any tap water or drawn water at all. So there are certain mikvos that that have this. I think in Muncie, the huge central mikvah in Muncie, is constructed in this manner that they did get down really really deep, and all the water in the mikvah, I think even in the baths and the showers in the mikvah, they have so much water there in the natural spring that's underneath the mikvah, it's all run by natural spring water. Yeah.
When you have a well, you dig a hole, but you run pipes to go through there, and you have a pump or something like that. Would that be a problem with it?
A pump is an interesting shayla. So the only disqualification is if the water is in a kli.
Yeah, but a pipe is going to be a kli.
Pipe is not a kli. It has to hold water.
Ah, okay.
So if it doesn't hold water, so it's not considered a kli for this purpose, but it depends exactly how the pump would be structured. I'm not sure. Okay, so that's the story of the water here. Jenitztavu bedine mei nida. That we are commanded regarding the waters of sprinkling. Kolomar bedine be hazoya, meaning sprinkling. Nida doesn't mean a menstruating woman here, it means sprinkling. Dahainu maim chayim milravim be'efer para, shemazin bohem al hatmeim. So you take the water from this natural source, and then you mix it with the ashes of the para aduma, and then you take a hyssop and you sprinkle it on the people who become tamei due to contact with the dead body, and after that they can immerse in the mikvah and then become tahor. We'll show nida, so what does it mean? Nida, kelomar hazayah. In this context it means sprinkling. Milashon zrika, kemo vayadu even bi. It says in Megillas Eicha that they threw a stone at me. So that's sometimes that shoresh could mean sprinkling and not talking about a menstruating woman. So that's obviously the understanding of Mei Nida is the water of sprinkling of the Para Aduma. So it's interesting because this phrase is actually taken by Chazal to mean waters of a menstruating woman in another context. What do I mean? So that when they talk about the war with Midian, which is in Parshas Matos, so it says that all the vessels that you collected from Midian, it says you have to kasher them. It says all the vessels that are used in fire, you have to put in fire, and anything used in water, you have to rinse with water to kasher it, because it was used with non-kosher food from the Midianites.
Just rinsing it with ordinary water?
It says if it's fire, if the vessel is used on the fire, you have to kasher with the fire, and if it's used with water, you have to kasher with water.
What kind of
boiling water?
If it's hot water, use hot water. If it's cold water, use cold water.
You don't have to.
I mean, like glassware.
Oh, we're getting there. So it says in the pasuk there, ach b'mei nida yischata, but it has to be cleansed with the waters of nida. So the simple understanding is that means the ashes of the para aduma. That because this was a war, there could have been dead bodies galore everywhere. So then they has to be, in order to become tahor, that shouldn't have tumas meis associated with these vessels. It has to be sprinkled with the waters of sprinkling of the para aduma. However, there is an additional level of interpretation that Chazal received that in this context, mei nida actually has an additional meaning of the waters of a menstruant, meaning that the vessels have to be immersed in the mikvah before they are used. Mm-hmm. It says ach there also, so that's another, that ach usually adds something extra. So it means that if after they're kashered, they have to be immersed in a mikvah as well. And according to, it's very circular, but according to some Rishonim, there's actually a source that a Nida needs to go to the mikvah in order to resume relations with her husband. It doesn't say explicitly in the Chumash anywhere that a woman needs to go to the mikvah after before being with her husband. Again, one would assume, certainly, that it would apply the regular, any rules for Tumah and Tahara in order to go into the Beis HaMikdash or to come into contact with things that are Torah, she would for sure need immersion in the mikvah. But how do we know that it applies to the regular relationship with a husband as well? So the Rambam holds that it comes from the fact, so sure, anyone who's tummy that has to go to the mikvah, so it's the same for the husband. But others say that the source is that for this, achle mei nida, which is not the simple reading of the pasuk, but okay, yeah.
Yeah, no. Kate, no.
Who's in the pot?
Sure, because there's no power.
There's no tumantara. The only quasi tumantara thing that we have with kalim is tvilas kalim. Like that's learned out from the phrase mei nida, which is in Parshas Matos, which again is not the simple understanding of the mei nida, but it's not a separate mitzvah in the Sefer Chinuch. So we could talk about it because it's Meinida. It's talking about this, it's related to this this phraseology. So it's a question as to whether Tfilas Kelim is a Deraisa or a Derabanan. So some Rishonim say that it's, most Rishonim seem to hold that it's Deraisa, even though, again, it's not the simple reading of that Pasuk over there, but that's the tradition of Chazal. And the Rambam writes that it's Midivrei Sofrim. Mm-hmm. So when the Rambam writes Midivrei Sofrim, he usually means like a very ancient type of almost intermediate thing between a Deraisa and a Derabanan. Mm-hmm. So it is potentially at least more stringent than a regular Derabanan, even if not Deraisa. Yeah.
Okay, so if a Kli has too much mace, for example.
Yeah.
And then it have the same rules, for example, as it does where they, a Kli that you know, needs regular tevila, if you go ahead and say you remake it in some way, you know, in other words, if you, you know, in other words,
Yeah, if it becomes uncleified, so it becomes tahar.
Okay,
yeah,
it has to be. It has to lose the shape of a kli first. You have to bang it out to a flat sheet and then form it over again.
No, you don't even necessarily have to do that. So, when something is uncleified, so it, when it's no longer a kli, so it becomes tahar. So there's a shear for different types of kalim for how big a hole it has to have in order to become tahar. So when you have a pot, for example, that has a huge hole at the bottom or on the side, wherever, so somewhere where they can't even serve as a pot anymore, so then it will become tahor.
Right.
So,
right, okay.
So what you're referring to by regarding regular tefillas kelim that we do nowadays is that you have this eitza that if you buy a kli from a non-Jew, so you have to do tefillas kelim. Based on this pasuk from Melech Hasmidian, that when they took goyish kelim, they had to tovel them. So the whole institution only applies when a goyisha vessel comes into the possession of a Jew and is going to be used in a Jewish household. So the Yerushalmi says that it's like a gerus, it's like a conversion, that the pots used to be goyisha pots, and now they have to be Yiddish pots. They have to convert the pots. So sometimes doing that is somewhat difficult. So let's say you have a huge, gigantic pot that it's impossible to, not impossible, but very difficult to schlep to the mikvah. Or won't even fit in the mikvah.
Yeah.
You have to go to the ocean.
Commercial, you know, you have to go. Those great big commercial bags.
Your friends in the Hamptons would have to, would have to immerse it in the ocean. You have no choice, but you wouldn't be able to fit it into the little Kalim mikvah here in Washington Heights. So another way of getting around the problem of Tfilas Kelim is that if you destroy the vessel in a way that it's unusable for its original purpose, and then the Jew reforms it. Now he fixes it. Now he turns it into a kli. So therefore, it's no longer a goyish vessel that came into a Jewish household, but rather it is now a vessel that was made by a Jew and would not require any tefila. Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting, because the whole thing that there's some guy in Lakewood who goes around having this eitzah that he uses on, say, like a coffee machine, like where he basically would break it by cutting a wire or something like that, and then solder it back together. Now the problem is, I see though, is that's not the part of it that's the kli.
Yeah.
That is actually, because the kli is basically the mechanism thing, the reservoir is the thing which actually heats up the water, and the metal part that goes that. But it may be unusable for his coffee maker, but it's
so maybe that is good. Maybe that is good. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Maybe that is good. Hmm. Didn't you show me an article about that? In the
article? I don't know. I heard about it someplace. So the whole question there, the article was, okay, is your average Jew handy enough to be able to go ahead and do it himself, or do you need an expert to go ahead and fix the thing?
Like the scissors grinder, like your old-fashioned scissors grinder.
I know how to go ahead and fix a broken wire inside a thing, but, I don't know, maybe somebody else wouldn't, that's a whole discussion there.
Right, so... Okay, yeah, so you have this issue also, with any electronic device. So officially on the instructions for the device, it always tells you, you are not allowed to immerse this in water. This is, it'll break the thing. So the problem is, some of these things require tefillah. Like you have this problem a lot of times regarding an urn, a hot water urn for Shabbos. So... you got to tovel it. It's a vessel that's used for food preparation. So you have to... So some people are very nervous because of the instructions, but the truth is everybody knows. It's a secret in the... Well, it's an open secret in the Jewish community that if you immerse it in the mikvah and then you let it dry for a few days, so then it's going to be fine. Nothing's going to happen to your...
That'd be true of... one second. That would be true of a regular old-fashioned, hot water urn.
Yeah.
But nowadays, things with electronics in them, very likely, you could...
So get an old-fashioned one. Who told you to get the newfangled one?
You have your electronic coffee maker or whatever it might be. You can't, that won't work, so...
Oh, that. Oh, that's a different story. You're right.
Okay, right.
All right. So this whole requirement applies only to what's called klei seuda, vessels used for meals. I mean, it's for food preparation, for serving food. But things that don't come into contact with food are exempt from the tefila. There even is, it's interesting, it's a cute discussion in the Gemara, where one of the Amoraim said it wanted to immerse a pair of scissors that he was using for cutting cloth. Because as new, any vessels that you get from a non-Jew, you're supposed to immerse. So the other Amora said, no, it's klei seuda. That's all these things. Again, they're talking about stuff that's used on fire. You have to do in fire. And you have stuff that's used in water. You have to do in water to cleanse for the kasher from the goisha blias. And then you have to immerse it in the mikvah also.
So corkscrew, you definitely do not have to
put. Corkscrew, you do not have to. Well, can opener. Even knives.
Knives. All I use this thing is for cutting celery or something.
So celery's food.
Celery's food.
Yeah, but it's cold.
So?
It's not kosher. It doesn't play the rule of kosher here. This is goyish kludi, shall we say, okay? It's like some sort of a metaphysical...
Take that off the tape.
No, right? I'm sorry, but this is...
It's, well, it's not exactly goyish kludis, because if you borrow... If you borrow a vessel from a non-Jew, so then you don't have to tovel it. You're allowed to use it as much as you want. I mean, you have to kosher it if it's such as required, but you don't have to tovel it at all. So that's why another thing you can do, you have a vessel that's an emergency situation, that's difficult to tovel, so then you could give it to a non-Jew as a present and then borrow it back. So you're not really supposed to do this indefinitely when it looks like a complete... workaround of the mitzvah, but in an emergency situation, temporarily, so there is what to be what to discuss about this. You also have a major issue that you have a lot of Jews for some reason. How this cultural phenomenon came about is a little bit unclear, but you have a lot of Jews who are completely medaktik about kashrus, but they don't tovel their kelim. I don't tell them the kalim. So what? Let's say someone invites you to eat in their house, and they have this situation. Are you allowed to go eat in their house?
Do you ever ask your hostess whether she tells you?
Well, for normally you have a right to assume that if you go to a frum person's house, that they observe this halacha, saying there's certain times that you know. I mean, this nowadays it's not so common anymore. Nowadays, Baruch Hashem, there's the achshur dara that we're much more. People are much more cognizant of Tefillas Kalim than they used to be. I have someone I know who grew up in. Why? We could discuss why. Possibly it's because that in the old country, it used to be the men who would go shopping. And the men knew about this. And the women just got the kli when they're at home. So the man on the way used to go shopping. He used to stop at the mikvah. The mikvah was not like we have nowadays, very secretive. Only the women know where it is. And you only go in there at night. But the mikvah was always available. Women went there at night. But you opened the door and you went into the mikvah. They saw toveled it, and then they went home. And then the women just got it. So then when the women became common for the women to go shopping, and the mikvahs were viewed as just places where women go at night, so then it sort of fell off the radar. Again, someone should write a doctoral dissertation on this historical phenomenon. But now people are very much adapted to it. You have some, older people who are from, and they're like, oh, these new things the new generation is doing. Even if it's explicit halacha, like, the new generation is doing. But this is something that's I found that everyone is receptive to. Even people in the older generation who didn't do it nowadays are got with the program, and they started to do it already. Yeah,
years ago. Jewish press had...
Right, so you have this problem. So what happens if somebody invites... So some people that they keep kosher 100% in terms of the food, but they don't tovel their kelim. So you have a major problem. According to the simple understanding of the halacha, one is not allowed to use the vessels in such a household. Mm-hmm. It's really nothing to discuss. However...
Tell.
That's what I would say, right?
Don't ask.
So you don't. Well, yeah, but what if you know? Again, if somebody is a frum person, so you have the right to assume. You have the cheskes kashrus, but sometimes you know. So there are various ways that people have to get out of it. One is that there is a svara. I think Rav Shechter quotes Rav Kook as saying something like this. And it's also found in the Sefer Tvilas Kelim. There's a huge fat Sefer all about Tvilas Kelim. It's called Sefer Tvilas Kelim. He says, interesting, a novel idea, which is that it only talks in halachic literature that if a Jew gets a vessel that's now obligated in Tvila and he didn't tovel yet, and now you borrow it. So it says in the Shulchan Aruch that you have to dovel it. The Jew, if another Jew borrows it, once it's obligated in tefillah, so then yeah, you have to dovel it. So he says, well, maybe when you go to someone else's house and you're using the vessels there, you're not really considered borrowing it, because if you break something, so the host wouldn't expect you to pay. So really, you have no relationship with these vessels, so therefore you're allowed to use it. That's a huge chiddush.
Isn't Rav Shechter said that, you know, since almost everything is made by a corporation, it doesn't need to be able to begin with, you know?
So made by a corporation...
Probably owned by a...
Correct. China. So it's not owned
in
by
China?
A non-Jew.
Huh? In China?
Yeah, but maybe the corporation, I don't know, has...
You know,
like
a company in
yeah. But that's really... That doesn't mean you don't have to tovel it. That means that you... Rav Shechter is choshesh that you shouldn't make a bracha mm-hmm. on the tefillah. But to use that as a tziruf... Maybe, I don't know, that you wouldn't have to tovel if you were somebody else's house. I don't know, it's not so fashion at all.
House that yeah. your friend, you realize finally that
yeah.
you could offer to tovel them for
him. No, Shabbos.
No, but I mean, going forward.
No, you,
I don't mean
you could,
meeting.
But the person might be offended. What? I'm not religious enough. You're taking all my vessels and schlepping them to the mikvah. So the halacha really is that in such a situation,
evangelism.
You have, I think, Rabbi Zilber, other people write about what happens if you have a... teenager who's a Baal Tshuva, and his parents are willing to keep kosher but not to tovel their vessels. So is he allowed to go tovel them
in secret?
Let's say they go on vacation for a few days.
This is real.
It's very real.
Parents don't. And they say, I'll buy a kosher chicken, fine, but I'm not going to change my dishes.
Well, right.
Nuts.
Well, that's more of a...
trade dishes is more of a problem. We have to work on that separately. But the halacha really is that you're allowed to do that. You're, even the parent doesn't want you to tovel the kalim, so then you're allowed to sneak them out, and while the parent isn't
not good,
and you're allowed to it's excellent midos, other rabbi, you're preventing them from
what?
Not deceiving. What?
You take non-kosher dishes.
No. Let's say your parents, you're a Baal Tshuva, and your parents are willing to keep kosher, but they're not willing to tovel their kalim. So you're allowed to do it for them, but then you're. What if you break something along the way?
Yeah, right.
Then you have a serious problem. Yeah.
What about temporary kaling? Things like a soda can or something like that that you how are you allowed to drink soda out of a can?
So Rav Shechter holds you're not.
Oh.
Rav Shechter is Rav Shechter holds that you're not. You're not allowed to drink from a can or a bottle. Like, say you have a glass Snapple bottle mm-hmm. and you open it, so he holds you have to pour it into a cup before you drink from it, because you're not allowed to use the vessel without the toveling. So most people hold, well, for a can it's a little bit better, because for a can it's like a sealed thing, and then when you you're creating the kli. Well, a lot of people say, Rav Moshe Feinstein, I think, says that when you buy the whole thing together, so the kli is subordinate to the food inside. Right, exactly. It's like just holding the food inside, so therefore it's not a real vessel. But maybe if you want to reuse the Snapple bottle, then you have to tovel it. But then some people say even then you don't have to tovel it, because it used to be like the klipa, just the peel of the food, and then you, the Jew, decided to turn it into a vessel, so now it doesn't need...
It doesn't need
to be like... It's actually interesting. The Chazon Ish disagreed with Rav Moshe on this, and partly suggested it comes down to the difference between, say, Bnei Brak and Lower East Side.
Mm.
Lower East Side, you have a can of sardines, you open up the can, you throw away the can of sardines. The can itself is not anything. Open Bnei Brak, you keep that sardine can and you put, pins in it or something like that, or paper clips, you wouldn't throw away
food,
if you wanted to keep it just for paper clips,
it's not simply like a something which is completely buffled to the food. It's not like a...
Right, I hear. So aluminum foil pans, disposable aluminum foil pans. So it depends. If you accept the svara that anything disposable is not a kli, so then it's okay. But then
but
you
reuse them until they fall apart.
Okay, but that's also, according to some, that's called temporary. That is, if you just use them a few times until they get whole, so then that's called temporary. One also has the tziruf, perhaps, for this, regarding aluminum pans, which would be better than, for example, a temporary stainless steel pan or whatever, iron pan.
The I don't know such a thing about. Yeah.
So aluminum is not one of the metals that's mentioned in the Chumash.
That's right.
So maybe aluminum, and others say that others don't accept that svara because they say, no, it really just means any type of metal. But Lemaisa, I think you could be makel for an attempt for a that a disposable aluminum pan does not require a tefillah. If you want to be machmir, go ahead. But I don't
How
think.
How about glass?
Yeah.
Glass is also not mentioned.
Oh, I'll get to glass one second. Yeah. So glass, no. So the parsha talks about the five types of glass. Achaz azov is, I guess, of gold and silver and bronze and lead and tin. I don't know. I think that's the translation. It's copper, right? Copper. Choshes is either bronze or copper, right? Different. Depends on different sheetness of the translation. So glass, the Gemara says that glass, since you could melt it down and reform it, that's also considered like metal, and therefore it requires tefillah. So it's a shaila whether that line in the Gemara means that anything that's meltable and reformable is chayav d'oraisa, meaning that glass would also be chayav d'oraisa, and certainly aluminum would be chayav d'oraisa. Or it means that that's added on. If it's not one of the metals, at least not one of the metals mentioned in the Chumash, so that means it's only derabanan. So the most of the achronim assume the glass is derabanan, but there are shitas that hold the glass is deraisa. So what about plastic?
Right.
We had a discussion, whether it's a thermosetting or a thermoplastic, whether or not, in fact,
right.
It's,
so you
can actually melt it down and it won't destroy it. You know?
So the poskim assume, again, without consulting with, perhaps with a proper, maybe they should, proper authorities about the usage of the plastic and what happens when subject to heat. But the poskim assume that most plastics you could melt down and reform. So that's why the Minchas Yitzchak says that plastic is chayiv in tefillah, and this is in fact the minhag in Breuer's community, because the Rabbi Posen is a Talmud. Maybe Rabbi Breuer held it also. I don't know, but Rabbi Breuer was a Talmud of the Minchas Yitzchak, so he holds the plastic is chayav in tefillah. But most people assume, certainly if you hold that glass is even derabanan, so then certainly plastic didn't exist, and the chachamim never had a gzera. Mm-hmm. They never told you you had to tovel plastic, so you don't have to tovel plastic. Yeah.
What about rubber?
No, rubber for sure is not.
It's not. Because rubber basically is essentially like plastic. Then you can't take rubber and, you know, you try to melt down rubber, it's going to just, you know, burn like that. But that's true with almost all plastic, too. Yeah, I mean, it seems to be the rubber and plastic.
What about recycling plastic? What about recycling? They melt it down and make new things.
Well, plastic? No. Yes, it depends on the kind of plastic. This is very like a vinyl, you know, like a soda bottle. Okay, that actually can be, you know, reformed, melted down, reformed. Most plastics can't. Something you go ahead and you use for most of this, whatever you, things you use for a you know, like a rigid plastic, something like that, is cross-linked.
Okay,
which means basically the whole thing is one big molecule. And that you can't, you know. It can't, again, it's going to depend upon the kind of plastic.
Oh, so if you can melt, there's nothing to discuss. If it's, yeah. But if it's a type of plastic that, like a soda bottle, like you say, that you can melt down and reform, so then that would be subject to this.
Actually, I have to look that up. I'm not entirely sure. It could be, by the way, that they simply grind it up and then they reuse, you know, and remake it, you know, and usually use a raw material. I'm not sure they actually melt it.
The mice say you don't have to tovel plastic. Don't tell Rabbi Posen I said that. Don't tell them. Yeah, Lemaisa, you don't have to double plastic, so don't worry about that.
Disposable anyway, so, yeah.
Right, and disposable plastic, certainly. So, right, so going back to the question of whether you're invited, when you're invited to someone's house, so the best eats is to try to use plastic. If you get them to serve in, certainly. If you cook food in non-tovel kelim, it doesn't affect the kashrus of the food. It's only a prohibition to use it, but it doesn't affect the food b'diavad.
You can't use it. That means you can't eat it.
No.
You can't cook in it.
No,
you can't use it.
So, Mrs. Friedman does not know that there's such a issue as tefillas kelim, but she keeps kosher 100%. She has separate milchiks and fleishiks, only buys from the kosher butcher, etc. So if she serves you a steak that she makes in her house on a plastic plate, then you're allowed to, or a plastic fork. Right. Even though she made it with a non-total pot, there's no prohibition whatsoever.
She is over on not
using it. Right.
However,
correct.
You are only over if you are using
it. Using it. The only prohibition is using.
You're not
There is a very minority sheet on the Rishonim, actually, that does ask for food. But we don't pass on like that. So the prohibition is only on using.
Mm-hmm. So what about porcelain? Put plate, whatever this.
Porcelain,
do you travel it or not?
Porcelain is an issue because it's on the inside it's earthenware, which is exempt, but then it has a glazing. The question is whether this glazing is significant enough to be considered like glass, and then you would have to tovel it. So a lot of people don't tovel porcelain for that reason, but it's not 100% clear. If it has a significant glazed coating, then maybe you should. So plastic, since it's a shiloh, it's not explicit. Metal and glass is with a bracha, and everything else is without a bracha, yeah.
So I, when I do it, will take something like metal or glass, make the bracha, and then do the
bracha. Yeah, that's what you should do. Yeah, why not? So that way you get to make the bracha. But you don't have to double plastic. Oh, okay. I mean, you can continue. I'm not saying you're not allowed. You can if you want. But
you can't
without a bracha.
What? Without a bracha, of course. Yes, 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 yes. So if you go to someone's house, so get them to serve you in, glass would be better than metal because maybe glass is only the rabbanan. And there is also another sheet that you could potentially be mitzarif. I think the sheet of the Rid, which holds that Tvilas Kalim is only an obligation. When you buy a goyish vessel, you must tovel it, but there's no prohibition on using the vessel before you tovel it, which again is against the normally accepted halacha. One should not rely on this normally. According to the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch, almost everyone else says that there is the point of Tzilas Kalim is to allow the vessel to be used. So obviously you're not allowed to use it before you tovel it, but there is this minority shita that with tziruf of other things, one could potentially rely on that in an emergency situation. If you go to someone's house and you're in a very uncomfortable spot, and they serve you a vessel.
What do you mean by stoneware? If the plates are stoneware, or the regular kind of
plates. So that's okay.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So most people are actually going to serve you on plates that are going to be all right.
So plates. Plates is also, I think your Moshe says that plates, if you go to someone's house and they serve you on a plate that hasn't been toveled, that really should be toveled, so that's not as bad because you're not using the plate. The hostess just put the food in front of you on the plate, but if you pick up the fork and the knife and you start eating, then it's
flat. It's not a cleat unless it's, if it's flat.
No, it could be a cleat. For this it is a cleat.
And then you eat it with the knife and fork.
Because you're not using the plate. Who told her to give it to you in a plate? You could put it directly on the table. Right. So soup, he says, yes. The soup you couldn't eat. A goyisha.
Manufactured by.
Right. Right.
By non-Jew.
Manufactured by.
By non-Jews.
Yeah.
In other words,
big anonymous
they're not,
company.
They're not. So if you manufacture in Israel, I don't know.
So if you manufacture in Israel by a Jewish company, especially a from Jewish company, so you have a minority sheet also that not from Jews would also potentially engender an obligation of Tvilas Kalim. So usually it's a good idea to tovel stuff you buy from Israel unless you know that it had an unbroken chain of transmission from a from company to your table.
And also you should always tovel Kiddush cups and things like that because guess who, it's not from Jew who made it.
So I usually do, just in case. I usually do tovel Kiddush cups, but I can't tell you. If you go to the store, like a silver store in Brooklyn, and the silver and the owner of the silver store is a firm person and says, I bought it directly from the company in Israel that produced it, and it's never was in goyish hands. I can't tell you there's absolute obligation, but just to be on the safe side, there's room to be
with or without a bracha.
Without it, for sure. Whenever there's a suffix, you don't make a bracha. In fact, there is a shita, interestingly enough, that you don't make a bracha at all on Tvilas Kalim, ever.
Because of the corporations?
No, because it's like kashering. Just like you don't make a bracha when you do Haggala on a kli.
That's true.
So you don't make it. It's just part of the
process.
Process of your, if you want to use it, so you have to tovel it.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So it's not an independent mitzvah. That's obviously the polar opposite of the shita that I mentioned before, the minority shita that there is no prohibition of using the kli at all before toveling. Mm-hmm. Then it's a specific obligation. And obviously, you have to make a bracha. But if the whole point is to remove the prohibition to use it, so then maybe you shouldn't make a bracha at all. That's why a lot of poskim say that when there's any doubt whatsoever as to whether you make a bracha, then you shouldn't make a bracha. So either this corporation business, which maybe is not such a strong svara by itself, but in combined with this, perhaps when there's any doubt whatsoever about whether you have to tovel the vessel, you should not make a bracha. And some say also, and because of the corporations, they say a different part, that the reason for Tvilas Kalim is that the vessel was going to be used for treif. So even if it's new, you still have to tovel it. So the etzem of tvilas kelim, the major fundamental thing is that this vessel was used to cook treif. So you have to kasher it, and then you have to tovel it. The tovel it meaning that just because it's inappropriate, that you have to just an extra thing, hosif lakosu tvila tara cheres, that it's not sufficient just the kasher. You have to put in the mikvah to show our disdain for the treif foods that these vessels have absorbed. So even if it's new, the reason you have to tovel it is because it was in a goyish house, it was sitting in a box somewhere in the closet, and the goy was thinking, oh, this, I have this thing in this closet, this pot. I can't wait to cook my pork stew in this pot. But some say that if the vessel was like in a store and it could be sold to anyone, it was never like omed to be used for treif, it was never designated for use for treif, so therefore, maybe you shouldn't have to tovel. Again, this is not halacha lemaisa, but maybe that's another reason why one shouldn't make a bracha.
Good thing we tovel those oysters.
Question.
Yeah.
This is maybe slightly far afield. What happens if, you know, somebody had a set of dishes for 50 years, they didn't use them, and they always say that after a certain amount of time, the kosher question isn't such a big question.
Your grandmother's dishes.
Yeah, your grandmother, fine, somebody's dishes, you get them, and you don't know what was used on them. Probably they weren't kosher all the time. So can you take them and tovel them and use them?
Well, toveling doesn't have any effect on the kashers per se.
But the
halacha is regarding wine vessels. So when you have wine vessels, and there are a couple ways to kasher it. One way to kasher the wine vessels is that you fill it up with water three times, changing the water every 24 hours.
If it's glass or just any?
No, any
like
wine vessel.
Like a wine barrel. Even.
Yeah, a barrel, any type of wine vessel.
The
glass thing comes from this. The glass thing is an extension of the original.
They used earthenware.
They used earthenware in the times of the Gemara. And then in Europe, they switched to wooden barrels because they discovered that makes the wine taste better when it absorbs the flavor from the wood. So they have to do that. So another way to do that, if you don't want to kasher it in that manner, is you leave it for 12 months unused. So if you leave the thing for 12 months unused, so all the wine sediment is considered to be dried up and no longer has the status of wine. It still exists, but it's not considered any wine because it's completely dried out. So you're allowed to use the vessel now for kosher wine.
That's only wine, though.
So
chazer has no half-life. In other
so words, you, Paskin, not like the Chacham Tzvi, that the Chacham Tzvi says that this applies to anything, that any vessel that hasn't been used in 12 months is now kosher, because any non-kosher thing that was absorbed into the vessel is not... is no longer considered to be food, really, and it's totally dried out. So the truth is that most poskim disagree with the Chacham Tzvi, because that should be mentioned in the Gemara somewhere that this works if it really were true. But in a combination with another lenient factor, so then some poskim are makel to use dishes where there's some question as to whether you'd be allowed to use them if you wait 12 months. So there's no possibility to kasher it. Right, there's no possibility to kasher it. Correct.
Then
you
take it to toilet.
Correct. So the tovling, yes, the tovling is supposed to be done after the kashering l'chatchila.
These dishes that have been sitting forever, they still have to be kashered with the glass.
No, if you hold like this 12-month thing, then you don't have to kasher it. No.
And so what about burying in the dirt? People who know nothing about kashrus, we say, I'm going to keep it kosher now. They say, you have to bury anything in the dirt? You know, that
comes from the idea that for the knives, you clean. The Gemara says the one way to clean a knife from non-kosher residue is to stick it in hard ground. Mm-hmm. But so somehow that morphed into sticking the knife into, I don't know. Became a folk thing.
So you have dishes from your grandmother, your aunt, whoever, and... is a Corel or whatever. So you let it sit.
Well, Corel is glass, so that's more. Corel is glass, so that's more lenient.
Okay, your grandmother's whatever, you know.
Mice
so you
China.
Leave them for a. So you leave it for X amount of time and then it's all right.
If you have a Lemaisa Shaila, we'll discuss it in a private context.
No, but I knew somebody who did.
There's what to discuss. There's definitely what to discuss.
In the grandmother's dishes.
There's definitely what to discuss about this. There's room to be...
cases if you don't risk it.
Okay, so let's at least get to finish the first paragraph. Okay, so the real meinida, which is the sprinkling of the ashes of the paraduma, is benitzavinu bedinam hayadua b'koso shemetaren atomei kemoshe namar. So these ashes purify the impure. V'izahator hatomei umetamin ator tumachamura, and they, if you come into contact with them and you are tahor, so you become tamei. We can totally understand why it should be such a switcheroo that it impurifies the pure and it purifies the impure. Midine ha-mitzvah, the luchos are as follows. Ma'ashamr zifarim lebracha, sh'amayim sh'nosnim al ha'efer, ein memalin osan ela bekli. This procedure is actually a little reversed because you're supposed to put the water in first and then you put the ashes on the water. Okay, but the pasuk says, Avinasan alav ma'im chayim el keli. So the pasuk says the opposite. That we're ordered to say for chinuch, but la halacha, you're supposed to put in the water first and then the ashes on afterwards, because then it's recognizable the ashes in the water. If you put the ashes first and then you put in the water, so it's gonna just dissolve right away. So what do you do? Ein memalin osar ela bekli min hamayonos hanovim min hanaros hamoshchin. So it has to be a freshwater river or a spring directly from a spring. Unasina sa'efer al hamayim, and maybe from the ocean. Actually, this works for paraduma. The discussion in the Mishnah. Unasina sa'efer al hamayim hu anikra l'rabbeinu zichron l'racha kiddush mechatos. The sanctification, sorry, of the water of purification, and that's how you do it. V'hamayim shu nosin aleim ha'efer heina nikros. So the water is called the water for the purification, and when you fix it all in, it's called meinida, the water is a sprinkling. Everyone is allowed to fill up the water for the para aduma water and to mix the para aduma efer in. Except for a deaf mute, a mentally incapacitated person, and a minor.
I think that they're extraordinary costs you have to pay in order to make sure that the water has not, you know, coming from,
So last time we learned, because when you make a para aduma, you have to, the Chachamim said that you have to do it in a super tahor manner. And the sprinkling of the Kohen who makes the para aduma has to be done, the preparation of that water has to be done by people who have never become tamei meis in their lives. So you have the, you take the kids and you raise them special in a separate, in a specially, isolated environment to make sure that they don't receive any tumas meis. So if that's true, so Rabosai, so how could it be that a kid could make the water of the paraduma?
Which said you can't have a cotton.
It says that a cotton is possible. So how could you have the kid do it? How does this help you? Oh, so a few terutzim. One is Toysis says that it only applies to the mixing of the ashes with the water. But the drawing of the water can be done by a cotton. So that's one teretz. Teretz number two is the whole thing that the person who needs to, that the Kohen who's making the para aduma needs to be sprinkled with the previous para aduma water. That whole requirement is only derabanan. That's not midaraisa. And normally, if you assume that if the Kohen is tahor, you assume that he's tahor. So you wouldn't have to separate him for 7 days and sprinkle him every day, like this whole procedure that we described last time. So for this chumrah, so a cotton would be acceptable.
Okay, but the total is, though, anybody's been isolated from the time they were born to be a shoteb, you know, by the time they were going to...
No, they have this whole group, you know, living in the, you know, this environment.
Did that ever happen? The quarantine nursing?
Apparently.
Yeah. That's what he said.
That if you do working with something else while you fill up the water and you carry it, you have to be doing, if it's possible, you have to be doing just this. But you, this does not apply once you mix the water with the ashes. V'asachar gam kein posel b'kiddush v'azayu. You cannot take money for it. No salary, no wages. Ketzad anuta schar l'kadesh olahazos d'meimav k'mei mayrav efro k'efer makla. Meimav k'mei mayrav efro k'efer makla. So if you take money to do it, so your water is like not water that you drew from a spring for paraduma, but rather it's like water that you collected from a putrid pool in a cave, and the ashes that you mix in are like ashes that you get from an oven. It's totally nothing. Notos chalar milui eno posel. I'm sorry. That applies only if you mix them or you sprinkle, then taking money is no good. But you could take money to draw the water. It's actually maseches parah v'noikes bizman habayis in the times of the Beis Hamikdash. So if you try to do it nowadays, so then maybe you really do need someone who never became Tamei Mace, because we have no mechanism to make someone tar from Tamei Mace. So in order to get this done, you have to have someone do it. B'zachar munikevos, males and females, shekulam tzrichen azoyim nitmul b'meis, kodem shekansu l'mikdash o yochul ha-kodshim. So everybody needs to be sprinkled upon before they become tar. Misha avar alzev elo kibel azoyim tzarech la bital aseizeh, you neglected to follow this commandment. Horkosat mitzvah kodem eski ramban zichon avracha, lo yimna b'cheshbon ha-mitzvahs kol dini ha-tumus var yosav, chachazokos b'sefer ha-mitzvah shol mitzvah tzarivav. So the Ramban holds that the what's called Tomei and what's called Tor is not considered to be a separate mitzvah, but the Rambam does. But of course, the Rambam agrees. Ramban agrees with all these rules.
But there is a little issue with the question of are they children, because in fact, the Sefta claims that they particularly only use children 8 years and under.
Right. So otherwise, you could say that they lived in this environment, quarantined environment, till bar mitzvah, and then there wouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, they say explicitly they're not.
Yeah.
They have bar mitzvah.
Quarantine, right? Make sure they don't go to funerals.
Well, sort of like